Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of The Bog right here on Dave Martell YouTube channel. If you like The Bog, support The Bog, make sure you go to patreon.com/The Bog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody. $5 all the way up to $50. You can get a sticker, you can get a mug, but most importantly, you get the RSS feed to listen to us, the audio of all of our shows in your car, on your commutes, at the gym, or at work. That is patreon.com/The Bog. You want to help us keep the lights on another way, make sure you go to shop.spreadshirt.com/Bog Shop. Winter's still raging up here in the Northeast. Make sure you get yourself a sweet Bog beanie, hoodie, all kinds of good stuff there. Dresses for the ladies and onesies for the babies. Shop.spreadshirt.com/Bog Shop. If you want to support a friend of ours, make sure you go to facebook.com/IronAgeJodish and check out our buddy Neil John. He's got some authentic Vedic astrology. Very, very cool stuff. If you decide to get a reading, make sure to tell him Big Dave sent you. That is facebook.com/IronAgeJodish. Guys, Bizarrkives 2 is out. We got another book on the way, so make sure you get caught up with all of the Bizarrkives catalog available at thebizarrkives.com. We are a compilation of short stories in the genres of sci-fi, fantasy, and cosmic horror. So if you like Robert E. Howard, you like H.P. Lovecraft, and you like the pulp masters of the golden era of fiction, make sure to go over and check that out at thebizarrkives.com. Follow us on Twitter and Telegram at thebizarrkives. Tonight, we have, once again, one of my favorite guests, one of my favorite people of all time. I absolutely love all of his work. Tremendous guy, big brain. Does some of the most beautiful, awesome books that are available on the market. We have Mr. Mike from Imperium Press here to talk about his newest release, Folk Tales in the Indo-European Tradition. How you doing, Mr. Mike?
I'm good, Dave. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. So, we got a lot to talk about tonight, but you gave me a little list of few points that we're going to hit, and then also I want to, but first, before we get into all of that, I just want to say, I don't have my camera up because my computer has been junk recently, but this is a beautiful book. This is a beautiful, beautiful book. It's about, what is it, like 800 pages, right? It's about 800 pages of folk tales in the Indo-European tradition. He's got stuff from, you know, you got Gaelic stuff, you got Germanic stuff, you got all kinds of stuff. And it starts with the earliest Indo-European, and then goes through the ages. It's like chronological order. And then paired with the stories and the commentary are these beautiful, old-timey, full-color illustrations that just add charm to this book. It's really, really beautiful. So, Mr. Mike, if you wouldn't mind, give us kind of an overview of this tome here.
Right, yeah. So, like, as you mentioned, it is a very thick book. It's, yeah, about 800 pages or so. And it includes, so actually there's a bit of a story behind it, and it's really the story of the genesis of Imperium Press, really. There's kind of like, you know, the company had like two like births, really. Like, one of them had to do with being dissatisfied with like academic editions of like reactionary figures and whatnot. And the other one was this book, really. So many, many years ago, I was gearing up to like just put together a little book, like a little collection of folktales for my kids. And I had done like a little bit of like, you know, Kindle publishing or something like that before. I'd done this with like one book of like, you know, I was part of a writer's group and we just put something together, slapped it together and put it out on Amazon. Uh-huh. So I was like, all right, I could do that. And then I was just like, okay, so we'll just, you know, I'll put together some like nice folk tales for the kids or whatever, just some like hand selected stuff from dad. And then that can just be like a little family heirloom or whatever that they've got. So I just started like, you know, doing that and everything. And I had read this study like from a couple of years before that was very interesting, that said like folk tales are really old and whatever, but I didn't really like think too much more about that. And I just kept, you know, compiling and everything. And then I like, you know, kept remembering this study, and I'm like, went back and read it, and I'm like, wait a minute, this is big. And what it is, I mean, we'll get into explaining it, but it, essentially the TLDR is that it explains that folktales are like ridiculously old. Like, some of them go back 6,000 years, mm-hmm. which is crazy. And I was just like thinking to myself, oh, well, wouldn't it be cool if I just like published, or not published, but like put into this compilation for the kids, like the oldest folk tales. And so I started doing that. And I was like, you know what? It would be cool if you'd have like a few, like, you know, because each of them like answers to a particular tale type, which is kind of like, we'll explain that too, but that's, you know, just basically a sort of like the kernel of a story or whatever. But wouldn't it be cool if you had like a few different like versions of each tale type to compare? So I started doing that. And then, like, long story short, I just eventually compiled all 50 of the tale types and three versions of them. And this became Folk Tales in the Indo-European Tradition, this book that we've put out. And, you know, I put it up on the website of Imperium Press because, you know, by that time the company was going. And people were just like, what's this weird Folk Tales book? When's that coming out? And I was just like, okay, yeah, it's coming soon, coming soon, coming soon. But people just kept clamoring for it. So, you know, we just put it together, like, you know, decided to go all out, you know, like get full color illustrations, write a nice introduction that like really goes into like the Indo-European reconstruction and everything that's like so near and dear to me and like the company in general. And yeah, that's kind of like where it landed. And it has just been absolutely killing it. People are loving it. So I was very, very pleased to see how well it's done.
Excellent. And also, with the stories, I went through and I've read quite a bit of the story. Obviously not even close to a majority because it is a very large book. But I've read quite a few of these stories, and they're just, not only do you have it has the cool artwork, you have it separated, like you have Proto-Indo-European, Proto-Indo-Western European, and it goes through all of these different things. And you got the cool artwork. I just love the aesthetics of this book. I could talk about that all. Before we get into the other stuff, who did the illustrations for these?
So this guy, he is an artist by the name of Gramon. I found him on Twitter, and I instantly recognized his art style because he's done work for Survive the Jive. I've seen him, like, some of his stuff around before. He reminds me a lot of this artist, this 19th century Russian artist named Ivan Bilibin. He's just got a really unique art style, Gramon, and it's absolutely beautiful. And I just, when I thought of, like, okay, well, it would be great to get someone to illustrate these, he was just the obvious choice because he's got this, know nothing about, like, you know, art critique or like the technicalities of like art history or whatever. So I can't tell you what the technique he uses is called, but it's very sort of sharp outlines and striking colors. And he's also super base too. I mean, like, you can tell, like, he doesn't really tweet out much in the way of, you know, stuff about like ideology or anything at all, but like everything that he does is infused with like the heathen spirit. And like, he does a lot of drawings of, like, you know, traditional myths and tales, and a lot of you know, he's a lot of what he draws and like his artwork is just like, you know, stuff from thousands of years ago, like what it would look like in a, you know, Unetiki village circa 1200 or 1300 BC or something like that. Like, he's totally on top of this stuff. So I was just like, okay, well, he's the guy for sure. And thankfully he was on board with doing it. So yeah, it was just a really good sort of like marriage of different elements all together. And like, the thing just really came together.
So
art actually reminds me very closely of something you'd see from King of Dragon Pass or its sequel Six Ages. If anyone in the audience has actually played any of those games, that's very high praise for a definite proto-Indo-European, sort of proto-Germanic feel to everything. It captures it extremely well.
Yeah. He actually gives me vibes of, there's an artist, a German artist in the 1800s named John Bauer that it reminds me of. He did all the art for Victor Rydberg's stuff, so if anybody's familiar with that. But let's get into, there's a word in here that you reference quite a bit, but obviously we got to talk about tale types. Tell us about tale types.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so what the structure of the book basically is, that, you know, it is all in reference to this study that I've already just mentioned in passing here. And what the study does is it basically like organizes these tails into tail types. Like it's probably good just to kind of explain the study, and then like that'll sort of lead us into the tail types. So there had been like quite a bit of disagreement about how old folktales are. Like since the 1960s, it's kind of been fashionable to say that like folktales are not very old at all, like maybe a few centuries or whatever. But the idea was, basically to make them into these one-off pieces that could be dismissed or whatever, so that Snow White could be like reconstructed on like woke grounds or whatever. But unfortunately, you know, for these people, you know, in the 60s or whatever, in 2015, this study came out basically saying, as I mentioned before, that folktales are like insanely old. So what they did in the study was they used like techniques that had been used in biology actually to study other social phenomena like languages. So the results that they got out of this in trying to figure out how old some of these folktales are not just like speculative anthropology. Everything they discovered is like a hard quantitative fact, like this, anything you would find.
I don't mean to interrupt, but is this what you were referring to when you say phylogenetic analysis?
That's it. Yeah, exactly. So they're using these quantitative means to figure out exactly how old these, or well, not exactly, but like they have a range of about how old they are, but it's very secure. So it's, you know, it might be a range, but it's definitely within that range. And so they took a bunch of these tail types and then plugged them into the analysis models. And what they got at the other side was that there are 50 ATU tail types that could be traced back to various stages in the major Indo-European migration.
And what does ATU mean?
And
real quick.
So ATU is, it actually refers to, there's, so like as back far back as like the Brothers Grimm, people have been noticing that you'd get the same basic story told in different countries of, you know, you might get it like Jack and the Beanstalk, but you get it in France and you get it in Norway, and then you'd get it in, you know, the Baltic countries or whatever. But it wasn't until about World War I that folklorists actually started cataloging these things. And the result was this system called ATU tail types. And the ATU, all that stands for is three guys, Arne, Thompson, and Uther, who basically carried out this work of categorizing. Okay. And so what these tail types are is basically the, like I said before, the little, like a kernel of a little story. So for example, one of the tail types in the book is the devil with three golden hairs. And it might go something like this. So you've got a hero, and the hero gets sent by a greedy king on a quest to bring back three hairs from the devil's beard. On this journey, he gets asked three questions by people who are like vexed by some insoluble problem or whatever. And then when he gets to the devil's wife helps him get the hairs, and also she helps him get answers to the questions. And then on his way back, he answers the questions, gets a big reward from the people. And then when he presents these three hairs to the greedy king, the king then tries to go off and like do the same thing, go on the same adventure to get the reward, and then he gets his ass handed to him. So that's basically in outline the story of the devil with three golden hairs. And I'm not sure if that's one of the ones you read, Dave, but it's a really good one. So that basically is the sort of rough outline of the three tales, like the three actual folk tales that we put into the book that answer to that tale type. So that little outline of a story is just, it's like one variation of a tale type. Some types are pretty flexible. This one, the devil with three golden hairs, has lots of different directions it could go, but it's obviously the same story no matter what direction. But some of the tale types are actually just one story with no variations. So, you know, these things are organic, like, you know, living things that have sort of evolved over millennia. So yeah, sometimes they're really naughty and like, you know, ramify into like many, many branches. And sometimes it's just very simple. But yeah, anyway, the point is that we have these tale types and they're distributed so widely that it can't just be a matter of borrowing. It's, you know, these things were handed down. So hence the study that tried to figure out how old they are.
Wow. Now, one of the first introductions I had into serious, I guess you could say, folklorism was Brothers Grimm. You know, the Grimm stuff, Jacob Grimm, right? And they had, what was it called? It was called Teutonic Mythology or something of that nature. And every, you know, I have a PDF one of it on my computer. A lot of, especially us heathens, that's something that we read very early on. But that was kind of my first introduction into kind of a serious study of folklore. And as you mentioned in your preface here, your introduction, about how we just kind of assume that these folklore tales are just kind of something, I believe you said, have a dusty, antiquated smell, right? But in actuality, after I started reading Grimm, there's a lot of elements in there that trace back very, very far. Now, you wanted to talk about, you actually wanted to touch on Grimm, because you do mention Grimm, the Brothers Grimm, and kind of their association to what we would understand to be like romantic nationalism.
Yeah, so this is something I just sort of mentioned towards the beginning. So, I mean, I should mention this for the audience. In this book, in the Folktales in the Indo-European Tradition book, I wrote the introduction to it. So it's actually like the first thing that I've written for any Imperium press release. I actually try and shy away from doing that. I mean, I'd rather people get like takes from like guys who really know their shit when it comes to all of this. But it is something that, because this book, like, you know, I've been working on this thing since at least 2017. So over that like long period of time, I did learn a few things. So I just thought it would be good to write the introduction. So anyway, I'm the one who wrote it. And in the beginning of it, I sort of lay out the background of like why folktales sort of came into prominence. And one of the aspects of that is romantic nationalism, which I think is something that like we need to understand. And that is, romantic nationalism is a really important part of how I got to where I am in terms of beliefs and everything. But without going into that, it's important to the folktales as well. So what it is basically, it's kind of, you know, sometimes thought of as like a liberal movement, romanticism, but really actually what it was, it was a reaction against liberalism. So you get this, like the cardinal thinker in the Enlightenment, the kind of like capstone on the liberal pyramid was Immanuel Kant, right? And his project was basically to put metaphysics on like a solid footing after Hume had just like completely given it like this drubbing or whatever about a generation before. So what Kant's project involved was what he called deducing the categories of reason. In other words, what he's trying to do is he's trying to strip away any sense of the particular, anything that's inherited from culture. And he's trying to look at the subject and basically say, how does the subject come to know the world? And the answer that he turns up is that there are these universal transcendental categories of reason that are shared by all rational subjects, right? So that's the Enlightenment. That's liberalism. This kind of like, this is like the big brain version of the liberalism that we all know and hate, right? It's the universalized, abstract individual stripped of all context and basically kind of like a shell that the world kind of impresses itself on. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's we can go with that. So now the romantics come in and they say, wait a minute. It's actually the context that's doing all the heavy lifting in terms of your identity, right? In other words, it's your culture, your particular situation, what Martin Heidegger will later call your thrownness into the world that does everything, right? You are basically your folk. And we get from this the idea of the Volksgeist, which is the German term that means folk spirit, yeah, or something very much like the folk soul. And this like Volksgeist, this romantic spirit of the folk is pretty much the precursor to like our thing, like, you know, our sphere today. And anyway, then we get the Brothers Grimm who step onto the scene and into this romantic nationalist, you know, stew wherever all these elements are swirling around. And they start investigating their own Volksgeist by looking for it in folk culture. and they find a, like this, just this huge reserve of it, just very, very deep well of like folk culture. So they collect as much of it as they can, as much folklore as they can, and then they publish their book called Children's and Household Tales. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the rest is history, right? Like, and this romanticism kind of starts as a German thing, but soon it's like spilling over into all of Europe. And soon you've got guys in England, in Russia, in Norway, in like all over the place doing exactly the same thing as the Grimms, to where like a century after they published their book, you could pretty much find the equivalent of like a Grimm's Tales in like just about every European country. So this sketches out a little bit of the background of where these, like, why folktales experienced a revival about 150 years ago or maybe 200 years ago. And it's, you know, a lot of the folktales that we have in this book, some of them I've commissioned for like new translation. Some of them have been like retold like anew, but for the most part, like 95% of the book is folktales that have been pulled out of collections that were basically like the ones that I've mentioned here, where it's like either from the, a lot of them are from the Grimm's book. Some of them are from like, you know, other books, the equivalents in England and other places. But yeah, a lot of it, you'll notice when you read the book, like a lot of it, it has sort of like this 19th century feel. And that's because of this cultural thing that was happening at the time.
Incredible. Now, I do know that you talk about in here about like reconstruction and stuff like that. Do you think that there is a way forward using folktales and what's the phylogenetic analysis as a way to do reconstructive things such as rediscover a ritual or maybe a holiday or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. So this study is super important. I think that like guys in our sphere, like even like academics, like Jackson Crawford could benefit a lot from, you know, reading the study and sort of like understanding what's in it. Because it does help us to reconstruct things. What it does basically is it gives us, it gives us hard information about how old certain folk tales are, right? And the thing is that like folk tale is not really easily separable from myth or legend, right? You will find a lot of these folk tale elements in myths, like Indo-European myths, whether from, you know, from Iceland to India, as the saying goes. So if you can find, you know, an element of a folk tale in an Indo-European myth, automatically you've basically got a date for at least that plot element of the myth, and probably others as well. So if you start seeing these things crop up in more than one place in the myths, you can kind of start to go, okay, so it looks like very likely this, you know, this myth is at least this old and maybe older. So one of the things I do in the introduction is I found three folktale types from the study that show up in the Poetic Edda. Uh-huh. So in Grotesonger, we get the tale type that's called the Magic Mill. 565, the Magic Mill. All these ATU tale types have a number and a name. So in this tale type, what we get is like a poor man who gets sent to hell. He finds this magic mill that can grind out endless amounts of like anything at all. And then so what he grinds out like loads of goodies and stuff. And then eventually it comes into the possession. The mill comes into the possession of a sailor. The sailor brings it with him on a sea voyage and asks the mill to grind out salt. But he forgot what the magic word is or whatever. He can't stop the mill. And so the boat sinks and it just keeps grinding and grinding and grinding forever. And then we're told that this is why the sea is salt. This is the folktale type. So we've got that. And that's a very, very clear parallel to Grotesonger. Uh-huh. And then you get elsewhere in the Poetic Edda in various of the Sigurd lays. I forget what the names of them are. But anyway, you get the element in the Sigurd story where the hero has to perform three like almost impossible tasks to win the strong woman as his bride. And this is a tale type exactly called the strong woman as bride. Sometimes it's actually called Brunhild, the strong woman, or the strong bride Brunhild, something like that. The name Brunhild is actually embedded into the folk tale type in some cases, because it's so clearly a parallel with the Sigurd story of him and Gunnar and Brunhild. So you've got that one as well. And then also this one is very, very clear. This next one you get from Fafnismal. It's the ATU tale type called 673, the White Serpent's Flesh. So in one of these stories, that's like, pretty, representative of this tale type, a man has to slay this mythical white serpent and give the flesh to an old woman who told him how to do it. And the old woman will cook and eat the flesh. So that's the deal, right? So he does that and then gives the flesh to the woman. She cooks it and leaves it to boil. But then while the flesh is cooking, he sort of like looks into the pot. He pulls off the lid, looks in, touches the broth and burns himself. And then he puts his finger into his mouth. And in the particular tale that I'm thinking, he gains magical powers. But in some of these other variations on this folk tale, he actually specifically gains the ability to understand the language of animals and birds. So the very, very obviously the same thing that you find in Fafnismal. So, I mean, these are obvious motifs. They're not even parallels. They're just like straight up plot elements that are found in the Poetic Edda. And because we know how old the folktale types are, we can say very securely that we know how old these parts of the Poetic Edda are. And it turns out that they go back a long way. They go back to 750 BC, not AD. They go back to 750 BC.
Incredible.
So, yeah, I when I discovered this, I was just like reeling. I'm like, holy crap, man. So, like, we can say that the Poetic Edda, in other words, is a very, very genuine heathen document. It's not just something that's like been distorted with like, you know, later interpolations of like other theologies or whatever. This is something that has been preserved very, very well. So that's the kind of thing that we can do with comparative folklore when we apply it to myth as well. And we can use it for other things. We can use it to reconstruct rituals. We can use it to say how old some of the other branches are. Like, you know, a Celtic is a branch that doesn't really get as much love because, you know, supposedly we don't have any myths from it, right? Any complete myths anyway. We've got these legends and they're priceless and beautiful and wonderful and everything. But, you know, how genuine are they? How old are they? Are
right.
they something
I,
that's
I can
like...
See where, I can see what you're going for here, because the main issue with Celtic mythology is that we lack any primary sources, so we can't validate the integrity of the myth. But if we can trace it back to a known folklore archetype, then we can use that to validate the content of the myth there.
Absolutely, yeah. And it turns out that we can do this, at least in one case or a few cases. So this one, this reconstruction is for O'Gravy. He's going to like this one if he's listening. So in The Voyage of Bran, we get a very clear example of the ATU tale type 470, Friends in Life and Death. So in this tale type, we get a man and his friend, and they're really good buddies, right? And then even after the friend dies, the man goes into the underworld to find his friend, to ask him to be the best man at his wedding. And eventually, once the two of them come back to the surface to get to the wedding, they find that everybody they ever knew has been dead from like hundreds of years. And this is exactly the same thing that happens in The Voyage of Bran, except instead of journeying to the underworld, the hero takes his men with him to the mythical land of women. And when they eventually come home, they find the same thing. Their ancient history and their deeds have passed into legend. They themselves have become ancient history. And what's remarkable about this is that this tale type here, Friends in Life and Death, is one of the oldest that we have. It comes near the beginning of this folk tales book, right? So it turns out that this Celtic folk tale or this Celtic legend or myth or whatever you want to call it, goes back to 2250 BC.
Wow.
Think about that for a second.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Tristan.
Yeah, I was going to say it's really fascinating to consider that very early Indo-European mythology featured what we would today recognize as time travel, because if that is a legitimate part of the mythic tradition, that really upends some of our understandings of what might be going on as people who take a more literal interpretation of religious phenomena.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it really confirms something for me anyway, which is that like traditionalism is about kind of recognizing that, you know, in a sense, time is somewhat unreal, right? Where you are basically, you know, what traditionalism is basically seeing diversity across space. So peoples are different, but unity across time, which is that you are your ancestors, and that there's a line kind of reaching back. So, and I mean, this might be reading a little bit into it, but I really do think that it certainly fits, at least that time is something that's a little bit, you know, malleable or whatever, or in some sense unreal. And this folktale tends to confirm that. Now, there's lots of other, I give a lot of different reconstructions like this in the introduction. You know, I know you guys want to keep it to an hour, so I don't want to go into all of them or whatever, but another one that I'll just touch on very briefly, and I can expand if you want, is that we have been able to reconstruct a Proto-Indo-European, again, a Proto-Indo-European ritual. So going back like to the, you know, Pontic Steppe, 5,500 years ago or whatever, wow. We've been able to reconstruct a ritual involving domestic worship of the, like, you know, tutelary spirits that take the form of the snake. So, yeah, I'll just kind of leave it at that. We've been able to do this with comparative folklore and like many, many other sources put together. This is the kind of work you can do, right? Like, basically, the only reason we know about the Indo-Europeans at all is because of comparative linguistics. And then from there, we get, you know, people start noticing other parallels. They notice that we've got these, you know, like the Indian Manusmriti is very, very close to a lot of the sort of like ancient Roman laws and Greek laws, especially to do with the family. So we get comparative law that helps us reconstruct the worldview of these people. And then we've also got, you know, modern genetics, and we've got other comparative sources as well. And now what we have here is comparative folklore. So the thing about folklore is that it's very much intact. You know, this is not something that was erased, or like we didn't get this a big, like, you know, series of book burnings to erase folklore. It has actually come down to us one of the most complete cultural expressions from our heathen days. And what we can do is we can use folklore to fill in the gaps of some of the other things that we've lost here. So I think it's really important that a lot of work needs to be done on this.
So before we move on from comparative analysis and reconstruction, I got one more question for you. And I know it's going to happen when people pick, not everybody. Yeah, obviously the bog lords and bog maidens out there that watch the show are more of a, you know, intellectual thinking variety, but there are people out there that are reactionary, and they're going to see a lot of these folk tales that mention the devil, and a lot of them mention the devil word for word, and they're going to say, well, that's not a, how is this a pagan or a heathen story? It says the devil, obviously this is contaminated with Christianity. What would you say to those people, and what does the devil represent in these stories?
So what the devil often represents is basically what the devil came to represent, or demons came to represent in like later Christian times, and not even later Christian times, but all throughout the Christian era. So very early on, the spirits, like the spirits of the ancestors especially, and the spirits, like the land spirits, And basically all the like tutelary spirits that people would sort of pray to on a day-to-day basis, not so much Odin and, you know, Jupiter and like these kind of things. But more the day-to-day stuff that like people would, do and like, you know, their domestic cult that they would undertake. What these things were kind of transmuted into in Christian terms was the devil or devils or demons. So what these people were doing in the Christian worldview was worshiping the devil or worshiping demons. And so what the demons often represent here, or the devil, is basically the old gods or the particular like land spirits of these like heathens. So for example, one of the examples I gave in the introduction is the legend of Paracelsus, who was this alchemist or like legendary doctor that like was so efficacious in his abilities that he just had to have learned it from the devil. He had to have struck a pact with the devil, right? And in the one of the legends that surrounds Paracelsus, it answers very closely to one of these ATU tale types called the Spirit in the Bottle. And basically what this is, in a nutshell, is that Paracelsus comes across this spirit who is trapped in a tree, in his case. He frees the spirit from the tree, and then it rewards him with, you know, granting him his magical healing powers. And then he ends up trapping the spirit back in the tree just by tricking it, basically. So I think this is a very, very clear example of a land spirit that's tied to a particular place, right? That has these like magical powers, these theurgic powers. So this is a very clear parallel and very clear example of one of these sort of like, you know, pagan spirits that might have been like tied to a particular tree or to a particular hill or grove or forest or something like that.
So not necessarily that, malicious.
No, exactly. So it's the devil, but that doesn't mean he's there to steal your soul or anything, right? I mean, in some cases,
But yeah, I was saying, you know, I find it rather interesting that you bring this up because just a couple of days ago, one of our listeners, Shruyan, was bringing up about how the modern folktale of the boogeyman actually etymologically refers back to a thing called a book. Or in old English term, a puck, as in puck from the character from A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Wow.
Which is very clearly in the dramatic tradition what we would refer to as a husvater, a house spirit.
Yeah.
And you can see how it's what is effectively a house spirit has been sort of demonized into a malicious creature. And I actually went through modern Scandinavian traditions of the Nissa to show about how they have a very well-established reputation of being vengeful and malicious if they're insulted or treated poorly, as such might happen if someone converted to Christianity.
Yeah, so, I mean, there are, like, you know, our ancestors, even, like, you know, we're not talking about thousands and thousands of years ago, but, like, centuries ago and well into the Christian era, we're very cognizant of the spirits and the things that like dwell in forests, right? Mm-hmm. The things that are particular to their special, like to their, you know, the place that they live, basically. And these have always had a very ambiguous relationship to Christianity because, of course, these folk beliefs are so deeply rooted, like they still persist, especially in like very rural areas today. So they couldn't, they couldn't be eradicated, but at the same time, they're very clearly antithetical to a universalist monotheistic, orthodox religion. So, they kind of just had to be contended with, right? And so what ended up happening, they obviously couldn't make their way into like official doctrine or dogma or anything like that. So what they ended up doing was being kind of like pushed down, you know, quote, down into folk culture, right? So that's where these things found a home because ambiguous as they are, it's you know, especially in like the pre-modern era, there's just no way you're going to be able to like go through the countryside and you know, in YouTube or in Facebook fashion, deplatform anybody that's talking about these things, right? So these beliefs in land spirits, in the spirits of the house, in the ancestors, these things have sort of transmuted themselves into, you know, in some cases explicitly talking about the devil, but certainly talking about, like, you know, other spirits like demons and like daimons and things like that. So yeah, anyway, that's kind of what that represents. It's not like, you know, we're not talking Anton LaVey here. We're not, like, it's not like devil worship, whatever. This is something very, very different and very genuine and ancient.
And I actually had a pretty interesting conversation with an Iranian guy over Telegram pretty recently. And I forget what his specific sect was, but he's some sort of sect of Islam that is specific to kind of his region. I guess it was some of Iran and Syria. There's, like, some of these people. And we had this conversation, and he told me about how his family does, like, you know, they do different offerings and so on and so forth. And I was like, isn't that kind of, you know, blasphemous or whatever? And he, you know, became, being a learned guy, he started telling me that in his view, a lot of the religions that boiled down the ancient stuff, because he said that these entities that they refer to as spirits or whatever, jinn or whatever they call them, these were the gods of the ancient people, and these were the gods of the land, he called them. Now, obviously, you know, we have discrepancies with how he interprets that, but this was just his interpretation. But he said that a lot of what happened in Christian Europe and among other sects of the Abrahamic religions was that they were influenced by Platonism, which originally boiled gods down to demons, and then the Christians took it down from there. So it wasn't even in his view, his religion was kind of uncontaminated by Platonism, and that Platonism was the influence that reduced the high holy gods of our ancestors down to, you know, demons or whatever. What do you think about that perception, Mike?
Yeah, I can see where he's coming from. I mean, Dave, you and I have tangled with the Neoplatonists before. Yeah, which is hilarious. But yeah, I mean, the fact is that Platonism, like Plato himself, and what's considered Platonism with a capital P, is a very inauthentic view of religion. Very inauthentic view, especially, you know, in particular of the Greek traditions. I mean, don't forget, Plato, like, hated Homer. Like, I mean, how un-Greek can you get, right? Like, everybody in his whole society would have disagreed with him on this, right? Mm-hmm. What lower P Platonism is, it's a metaphysical thesis about universals, and this completely runs counter to the sort of heathen worldview, which is that basically the particular is the sort of locus of metaphysical reality. And you get universals by looking at a bunch of particular cases. You know, this is kind of, in some sense, where we get, not really where we get polytheism from, but polytheism itself matches up hip and thigh with this idea of particularity, right? Like, you know, and universality with monotheism. And Plato, pretty much, I mean, Plato, it's hard to pin down what his religious beliefs were, but he certainly believed in the form, in the forms, the Platonic forms, obviously. And for him, the most real form was the form of the good. So basically every other form partook of the form of the good. So basically he was kind of some sort of a monist or some sort of a monotheist ultimately. And this is very, very different from any other, like, you know, genuine heathen or like Indo-European native theology. It's very, very different, right? So when your friend from Iran, who's obviously a Muslim of some kind, says that he has, like, his view on the matter or his religion has pretty much, like, discarded Platonism, I can see where he's coming from, especially if what he's doing is he's paying homage to the tutelary spirits that surround him, where he lives, and all that sort of thing, because it's exactly what his pre-Muslim ancestors would have done. I mean, again, these are the, like, you know, the sort of like monotheisms that come later are basically something that's kind of, it's like a branch that's grafted onto a root. The root doesn't get excavated. The people are always the same. Again, like the folk soul, the Volksgeist, the Iranian Volksgeist never dies, just like the Germanic one, just like the Indo-European one never dies. So these people are still pretty much the same, at least in terms of their folk soul, as what they were 3,000 or 5,000 years ago. So they are going to need something particular to themselves, and they're going to need basically what they've always needed. So yes, I mean, you can, the winds of theology can start blowing in a different direction, but they're always going to have to sort of conform themselves to the people itself that are the, you know, taking up the religion, or the vessels that carry forward the religion, which is why when you see, you know, Christianity throughout Europe, it very much localized itself. It looked very different in Northwestern Europe than it did in, you know, in Spain, or it looked different in Italy or in Greece or in like all the other different places. It's because fundamentally what's driving things are the folk soul of the people. And I mean, you get this in that wonderful book that people recommend by James C. Russell called The Germanization of Early Medieval Christianity. Basically, what happens is you get Christianity has to kind of conform itself to the Germanic worldview. Christianity was Germanicized more than the Germans were Christianized, right? And of course, later, I mean, things get a little more complicated with the Reformation, but that's basically sort of the order of operations. It's the people are kind of in the driver's seat as far as the shaping of the theology.
Yeah.
And this is the strength of folk culture, right? Because folk culture itself is a wonderful vessel for the preservation of what's truly ancient. And that's kind of what I'm trying to get across here with this book, in Folk Tales in the Indo-European Tradition, is that, you know, we was Indo-Europeans and we still is. And folk culture is a testament to that.
Yeah. That's incredible. You know, that reminds me, you know, I did an interview with a Peruvian guy, like, you know, a year or so ago, and I was on his show, and we were talking. His name, I don't know if I should say his name, but he's around. A lot of people watching his show have probably seen his show. He's like the only Peruvian guy that's kind of around in our circles. And during our interview, he asked me about faith, and we had a little brief conversation about faith. And I was like, you're a Catholic, you have a saint or whatever. He goes, I pray to so and so. I was like, that sounds like an indigenous word. He says, yeah, it was one of the old gods that we made a saint here. It's only here. And I was like, you know, that's, you know, kind of polytheism. And he just shrugged his shoulders. He's like, yeah, I pray to them. And I was like, you guys know that's, you know, that's the ancient religion. That's not Christianity. He goes, yeah, everybody knows. Like, everybody knows. It's all good. We still do that.
I like how they just flat out, like, just reject the entire point that it's completely incoherent to just go with it.
It's so cool. And actually, I looked, I can't remember what it's called now, but I went and I looked it up, and his culture does do that. They wear these like beautiful headdresses, and they do this parade down the road in the name of this saint that's an ancient deity, and they have a big festival. I was like, that's so cool. That's really, really cool. But before we start running out of time, I wanted to talk to Mike, since you put so many years and so much work into this just magnificent book. You personally, we talked about tale types and all that kind of stuff. Is there any tale types that are particular to you that you personally enjoy?
Sorry, I lost my mute button there.
That's okay.
Yeah, I mean, there are too many to choose. I really like this, the grass snake in the house one. This is that one that I was mentioning a little bit earlier about the domestic spirit of the snake. That I think what I really like about it is that when I read it originally, it was a sort of an aha moment that, like, you know, because I've been reading a lot of other sort of practical manuals of like on Hellenism and on Italic, like Roman reconstruction and everything like that. I saw this, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. This is the same stuff that these people are doing, right? And so it tipped me off that like folklore is a great for reconstruction. I like that one. I also like Godfather Death.
I love the art for that.
And one, that reminds me. Yeah, that's beautiful. It's kind of uncanny and weird, which is amazing. And that kind of reminds me a little bit of, do you guys remember Jim Henson's The Storyteller? This was a TV series that was on in the 80s, and you can find it on YouTube. I would like look it up, man. Like anybody who likes folk culture or heathen stuff or anything, look up The Storyteller by Jim Henson, the Muppet guy. Who and what he did was he put together this like little series of like it's not Muppets, it's like live action stuff from the 1980s, this beautiful renderings of, you know, fairy tales, basically. And there's this one, I forget what it's called exactly, but it is it involves the Godfather Death ATU tale type. And it's basically about a soldier, I think, who ends up sort of like tricking death to where he can't die. And then he just gets older and older and older, and he's just, you know, he just wants to, you know, he's put in his time. He's ready to go to heaven or whatever. Yeah, yeah. And so he just, he goes to the gates of hell because he tricked the devil, right? He tricked the devil into like letting him live forever. And then he goes to the gates of hell and he's like, guys, he goes to heaven. He's like, all right, so I'm done. You know, let me in. And they're like, no. You made a bargain with the devil. You're out of here. And then he goes to hell, right? And he's like, okay, so, you know, I can't get in heaven. At least let me in here. And they're like, no, screw you. You tricked our master, the devil. And so he's just like wandering forever. And it's just this really like eerie. It's you get the vibe of it is the same that you get from some of these folk tales, which is it's very eerie. It's almost like it's not quite horror or anything like that. But you do get a sort of shiver down your spine when you read these things. And anyway, that series is wonderful. There's a whole bunch of different fairy tales, and it's done in a beautiful like 1980s sort of organic way. It's, you know, there's no CGI or anything like that. It's just really nice. I like that one. I like Rumpelstiltskin. That's a good one because that's like a favorite of my kids. Mm-hmm. And I really like any Russian folktale. I think Russian folktales are some of the most weird and like psychedelic and crazy literature that's ever been written. Something about the Russians. I don't know what it is, but you read their folktales and it is really like, you know, taking an acid trip. Baba Yaga. It's great. And yeah, that one's wonderful. Actually, this one that I mentioned that was done into Jim Henson's The Storyteller was a Russian tale. There's a lot of great ones. So, yeah, it's hard to pick just one from the book, but I think those would be some examples.
Well, you know, Mike, I find it rather interesting that you mentioned the story involves him basically bargaining with the devil to extend his life, and he effectively just keeps aging and aging, right? Because for different things like I've done for other stuff here, I was actually looking into something similar, and there is quite clearly a theological connection here to the Greek story of Tithonus, which is in the Hymns to Aphrodite by Homer, and also the On the Old, which is part of the Ilingatal in the Noric tradition, and which is basically the exact idea of this. The entire myth theme here is that the person gets old, but they don't get eternal youth, and they end up suffering and wanting to die.
Very cool.
There's a Roman one as well that's in Ovid. I can't remember the name. It's just on the tip of my tongue, but it's like a goddess actually that like just gets older and older and older and can't die. I want to say Sibylla, but it might be something else. Anyway, yeah, this is a very, very widespread motif in the Indo-European world. It's preserved in folklore. It's preserved in myth. And clearly it had a significance to our ancestors because it shows up in a lot of different places.
Very cool. Mike, do you got time for a couple more questions, or you gotta get out of here?
No, we can go for a while longer if you want.
So I wanted to ask you, because right here you wanted to talk about, and this is really interests me, the false dichotomy of the folktale versus the classic. Could you tell us what that means?
Right, yeah. Okay, so, I mean, it kind of goes into what I was saying before at the beginning about how myth and folktale and legend are really hopelessly entangled, right? And as far as I'm concerned, folktales, I mean, people put like folklore on one side of the equation, and then they'll put something like Homer or Virgil or like the Poetic Edda on the other side of the equation. And, you know, one of the things that was, you know, surprised people a little bit is that we put this book, Folktales in the Indo-European Tradition, into our Western canon series, which is kind of weird. It's like, you know, is Jack and the Beanstalk really part of the Western canon? Well, I would say yes. Yes, it is. Actually, as far as I'm concerned, folktales just are classics. There's no real difference between those two, right? And I mean, what's more, I think actually folktales are kind of generative of the classics in the same way that myth is generative of the classics. So what I mean there, take something like the Virgil's Aeneid, right? This is obviously a cornerstone of the Western canon, but it's also straightforwardly an homage to Homer, right? This is kind of what I mean by something being generative of the classics, where Homer is something that generates another classic later on, right? And I think folktales are just the same. And, you know, you can't distinguish between folktale and myth. I mean, so for example, just look at the myth of Cupid and Psyche, which is another Ovidian, like, you know, from Ovid. It's a it's actually a Greek myth, but it comes into the Roman canon here. The myth of Cupid and Psyche is a very straightforward retelling of the folktale Beauty and the Beast. And if you read the study, you'll see that this tale type dates a long, long way back. The Beauty and the Beast goes back to the proto-Western European migrations. So we're talking the last common ancestors of all the European peoples, right? From memory, it's like about 2700 BC. So, you know, this folk tale, Beauty and the Beast, is that old. It's as old as any of the European branches. And it manifests itself in this myth, Cupid and Psyche. So, I mean, where do folk tales begin and myths? Where do folktales end and myths begin? I don't think that you can really answer that question with anything like definitiveness, right? Like we have this idea that myth is something kind of sacred and folklore is something more secular. But this is a bit of a problem, right? Because pre-modern peoples didn't really observe a neat distinction between the sacred and the secular. This gets even more suspicious when we consider that, like, all of the folktales in this book, like, all 150 folktales have some element of magic in them, right? Like, so we call this genre fairy tales. Like, there's clearly, like, metaphysical elements in folklore. So folklore can be absolutely sacred. And then, you know, as we've talked about already, we see some of these like folktale types that have pretty much just been ripped out wholesale and find their way into myths as plot elements. So, basically these things are totally inseparable as far as I'm concerned. So I think we could pretty much just like freely use folklore to help us reconstruct not only the myths themselves, but also the religious worldview of the Indo-European cultures going all the way back to the Pontic steppe. So, the dichotomy between classics and folklore, I don't really see that there is one, to be honest.
Incredible. And you also you believe that folklore can be something that we can use to kind of protect our children and bring our people back to vibrancy. You put a lot of stock into this stuff. You believe that this has real power. Can you kind of give us an explanation on why you believe it has this power?
Yeah, well, I mean, I put a lot of stock in it because I do it in my life. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, clearly we're in a bad way right now. I mean, we don't need to go into that. Everybody knows it, right? And pretty much like the first step, I think, I mean, I just don't see, you know, except for, you know, one, like some unanticipated, unprecedented, like, you know, master stroke of like political statesmanship or whatever. I just don't see us getting out of this current situation anytime soon. So we kind of have to take a long view of these things. It's not going to get solved in 10 years. It's going to get solved in 100 years or maybe more, right? Like, we didn't get into this situation overnight. We're not going to get out of it overnight. So we've got to do things like educate our kids, right? And so homeschool your kids if you can, because early childhood education really matters. I mean, most kids have their personalities more or less fixed by about age 6, right? Like, I forget where I've read that, but I've seen that a few different places. And I mean, there's some things that you can do even if you can't homeschool, right? Like, you could limit screen time. You can very closely sort of like manage what media your kids consume. You know, be careful with anything branded, like no frozen shit gets like, you know, allowed into our house kind of thing, right? Yeah. It's just, that stuff is terrible. So, I mean, but even deeper than all of that, even deeper than, you know, early childhood education or really sort of complementary to it, I think that the way that a culture can develop an immune system or maintain an immune system that can expel foreign viruses is by cultivating the love of home. And folk culture does that. This is exactly what folk culture lets you do. Like, you don't make people love their home by drilling into them like abstract philosophical points, right? But you do that by filling the place they live with wonder. So like, when you start to talk to your kids about like the things that live in woods, and, you know, when you talk to them about the gods and the spirits that dwell in the land and in their house, that, you know, the gods that live in their house and protect them from the thunder, you know, when they get scared and they hear lightning and thunder and you're like, don't worry about it, Thor's got your back. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. You start to make them feel that like the place they live is special, unique. You give them an attachment to it, right? And it's not just that, though. It's not just like the place. It's also your family rituals, right? Like, family time, it should be fun and special, of course, but it should be more than that. It should be something sacred, right? Like, for our ancestors, meal times, for example, were not just times where they sat next to each other and like chowed down on a plate of whatever. Meals were marked by a toast to the ancestors, right? They would fill a plate of food and set a place at the table for the spirits of the ancestors, all the people that went before them, their grandparents, these people who had names, right? Like, and this would probably also involve even like a ritual procession on special occasions and offerings made to the graves of their forefathers, right? And their forefathers who rested on the property that had been passed down since a time out of mind. I mean, you know, this may not necessarily be possible, like all of it possible today, but this is the kind of thing that makes family time sacred. And I would say that also extends to fun stuff like story time, right? You know, story time for your kids should be a real event, right? Like, one of the central events of the day where everything stops, all the kids kind of like take up their places, dad sits down and he makes this dramatic pause, and then he starts into his tale, right? And it's not just like a ripping yarn or whatever. It needs to be a performance. It needs to have a kind of like theater to it, right? I guarantee you, if you do this with your kids from day one, you get this same effect, right? And like, you know, when the wolf reveals himself at the end of Little Red Riding Hood, it'll send a shiver down your little girl's spine, right? Because you imbued the tale with all those ritual things, all those ritual trappings, and like that awe and terror that she feels when she hears dad tell her this tale. it takes on a kind of like religious character. And this is, you know, this is something your kids can't get from Peppa Pig on YouTube, right? Yeah. Like, this is something only you can give them. This is something that they will remember, that they grew up with, right? They'll do it for their kids, and they will be a lot more likely to love and defend their home, right? And I guarantee you, when something changes, when the great man, you know, strides over the horizon, it'll be because he loves his home, right? He'll come and, you know, basically BTFO our enemies because he's pissed off that they've defiled his home, right? So if we really want things to change for real, this is where it starts. It starts in the home. It starts with cultivating a love of the particular, a love of where you came from, and that sort of thing. So this is something that folk culture can absolutely do, and you can start small just by reading your kids' stories and really getting into it and making it a thing, making it a big event for them.
I love all that. I love that, man. That's so good. I love that whole shtick you just laid out for us. Telling your kids stories, the specialness of mealtime, little rituals. I feel that so much, man. When I tell my kids stories, I mean, everybody knows watching the ball game, watching me over the years, I'm a pretty animated guy. I turn it on when it's kid time. When I'm telling the story, a lot of times I'm just making stuff up as I go. Like, oh, Dad, let's do a story. And I'll tell a story about a dragon, and I do all the sound effects and everything, and I really get it, and they just love it. My boys are like, when the dragon breathes fire and the hero dives out of the way, they're like, they start chimping out, and they just love it, man. It's just so much fun. My little boys are terrified of Krampus. When Yuletide comes around, they are more concerned about the Krampus than they are about Santa Claus. They lock my oldest son locks the door every single night so the Krampus can't get in. They are scared of Krampus because I told them so many stories about. I brought up like pictures of on my phone, and I got this from my grandfather on my mom's side. You know, if you guys aren't familiar with like old Italian culture, they are such superstitious people, and the old people get such a pleasure out of scaring the crap out of kids. They just love it. My grandfather, my pop, used to sit us all around and tell us the most horrible, scary stories about demons and monsters and like just all kinds of stuff just to scare the crap out of us for the sake of it. And a lot of modern people are like, oh, why are you scare the kids? But now I'm looking back on it, that was magic. You know, that made my world like so much more enthralling and magical and imaginative. And if I didn't have that, I probably wouldn't be like writing sci-fi and fantasy stories today. That like gave that. I mean, I'm probably predisposed to writing this stuff. But growing up in a family that very much valued imagination and sacred things I feel so bad for atheists. I feel so bad for atheists, and I feel even worse for their kids that have to grow up in this sterile, homogenized, bland world where everything is just material and there's no such thing as ghosts and nothing is spooky. And that's fun, and that robs the fun out of life.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And, you know, your kids are going to grow up, and when they get to be adults, they're going to think differently, and like you thought differently from all the people that you know and your whole society, and why you ended up where you are, Dave, and why you're probably these scary stories were one of the formative events and why you became a heathen, right? Yeah. And like, so like when people don't really get a taste of like folk tales and folklore and you know, these weird eerie stories, when they don't get a taste of those as a child, they kind of come to it as adults, and they find them really weird. They're like this really rough-hewn homespun sweater that doesn't like fit comfortably or whatever. Like sometimes folk tales don't always make complete sense, right? Like at the very least, they demand this like total suspension of disbelief. And I mean, in this sense, like they put us in a pre-rational psychological space, in some ways kind of like a child's, right? Like children develop a narrative understanding before they develop an analytic understanding of the world. They see the world in terms of imagination, in terms of conflict and possibility before they see it in terms of cause and effect, right? And folktales are pretty much like pure narrative. There's like very, very little internal monologue or character depth, very little description or setting or anything. Everything's basically like a pure archetype. And the conflict isn't really between, you know, the characters so much as it is between like ideals, right? And I mean, I guys have probably experienced this. Like if you immerse yourself in like folktale and nothing else for like an extended time, which you can totally do with 800 pages, 300,000 words worth of folktales.
Yeah.
If you immerse yourself in it for a long enough time, and you get the same from myth, you start to think differently. Your whole worldview becomes permeated by the gods, by these archetypes, and the folktale starts to make a kind of pre-logical sense, right? Like the rational skin of the apple gets peeled away, and you see this flesh of the world all the way down to the core, and it's pure acausality and irrationality underneath. It's like, you know, for Sargon or like these atheist, like new atheist types, that's terrifying, right? And this is the kind of mindset that the traditional narrative gets you into. And I think this is actually exactly what we need, right? Like we need it because we got into this predicament that we're in, where we're just like bugman utilitarian instrumental rationalists who look at religion or like our deepest cultural expressions, and we try and like square them with what's rational. And I mean, like, let me tell you, there's no acid quite so powerful than detached abstract reason in undoing the glue that holds us together as a people, right? Like reason is not a good thing. Like in general, I mean, obviously it can be used for instrumental ends and we have to do that, but like this is something that is like, as people have been pointing out for many centuries, people like Vico and Maestra and Haman and others have been sort of hammering away at this point for a long time. What folktales do is they subvert that bug utilitarian mindset. They put us squarely in like pre-rational territory, what Julian Jaynes called the bicameral mind. And I think we need more of that today. We need that today more than ever. So yeah, I mean, like people who grow up with these stories that where their dad is sort of like, he just is that, you know, storyteller sitting by the flickering fire and like telling these fiery stories of like dragons and elves and, you know, the things that live in the swamp that you need to beware of, and the Krampus that'll get you if you're not careful. This kind of thing, like people sort of like, you know, sort of like in a modern, like, you know, degenerated sense are like, oh, that's just like, you know, that's terrible. You know, telling your kids lies. No, this is what they need. This is exactly what they need, right? So, yeah, your boys are going to grow up and they're going to actually be way more well-adjusted people, right? They're going to have to be inoculated against, you know, what you call the mechanurge, right? Which is a very real thing. So, you know, this is how you do it, right? One small step at a time, and it just starts with playing with your kids and telling them these stories so that, you know, there's a statement on what folktales can do.
I love it. I love it. Man, there's something that's very healing about living in a world that still contains mystery. You know what I mean? Like, I'm a very superstitious person. I really, truly am. And I'll fully admit it right now.
Same here.
Like, I believe in spirits and ghosts and evil entities and the supernatural and paranormal. I believe in all that stuff. It scares the crap out of me. There's times I hear stuff in the basement and I run upstairs like a scared fucking little kid. I'm not even sorry, and I'm not embarrassed to admit it. I am. But it gives me, I feel that it's like, it makes my world so much, you know, more colorful and vibrant. And it's just, I look back on that because I had a phase when I was an atheist. I had a phase, you know, when I was like an edgy teenager atheist or whatever. And I look back on that, and that wasn't natural. You know what I mean? That wasn't me. And that was me pushing back all of my like beliefs and everything that were me, right? So now that it's been years now since I've come back to faith, but now that I have my faith and I live in this kind of mysterious magic world, I feel like me. I feel holistic and organic, and I just feel that my life is so much better. And let me tell you, over the last, you know, last year or so since I started the Bizarchives project, and I read, you know, I read a lot of fiction now, and I've always read a lot of fiction. But since I've, like, you know, started reading submissions, and first, I wanted to mention this earlier in the show. When I, Mike, when I'm reading this book, I'm finding motifs that are in short stories, fiction short stories that I'm reading. You know, it's pretty crazy. I'm like reading these folk tales. I'm like, that is like the same plot as X short story that I just read, even though it's a sci-fi tale. You know, it's really incredible. And I guarantee you, these guys that put in these maybe some, but I would be really shocked if all of them knew that they were referencing these folk tales. It's almost like these things live in our folk memory, and they're just coming out, and we just understand these motifs like organically, and they're just telling the story because these are just tried and true immortal ideas. What do you think about that?
Oh, yeah, these things run deep. Like, they are sort of ingrained. They're like grooves in our, you know, mind or our spirit or our folk soul that, like, you know, once you sort of like start into that groove, you just follow the track all the way down, right? Something like a motif in a folk tale is something that's absolutely going to be picked up and, like, just subconsciously, pre-rationally, you know, it's just in there. It's just you. It's just part of who you are, right? Like, and you get this, it's sort of like analogous to something like, you know, how a good poet writes, you know. I mean, once in a while, you get an Alexander Pope who's very conscious of things like word order and chiasmus and like meters and like trying to like very consciously do the same thing that, like, you know, Saturnine poetic meters and things like that. Like, he's doing it like because he's trying. But the vast majority of like brilliant poets do that same stuff just without trying, right? Like, they just do it because it's in them and because they've read lots of poetry and they love it, and it just comes out of them spontaneously. They don't have to try. They're just like, when they get into the zone, they really, like, you know, when, like, you know, what the Taoists call Ziran, which is, you know, spontaneous action or action without action. You're not trying, right? Like, if you, like, you know, when you, If you're a musician and you're like jamming and things are going well and you really just are like on point and like every note is the right note and it's just happening for you, it's probably not because you studied, you know, Lydian modes for hours and hours and hours. It's because you're just in the zone, right? And it's because something is pouring out of you. And this is kind of how it works as a writer. Like, you'll see these things happening where, like, you see these motifs in someone like a Robert E. Howard, right?
Oh,
like,
yeah.
That guy had, he tapped into something very primordial, obviously. And you can see some of these, you know, folktale motifs come out in him, of course, because he was raised on tall tales, right? Mm-hmm. So he knew a lot of the sort of like folk culture that surrounded him. And it just imbued him. It was just like ingrained in him. He didn't have to. I'm sure he did try. I'm sure he did like research and all these things, right? But he didn't like sit down and like compare, okay, well, you know, what do all these like tale types look like? And how does it tie in with, like, you know, this particular myth or whatever? He just did it, right? He just sat down and started pouring out of him. And that's because his folk soul, something in his folk soul was activated by this. And so, you know, I can see that happening in, I've only read the first volume of the Bizarchives, but there's certainly, like, you get these deep resonances with, like, archaic narrative coming out of some of the stuff that's going on in the Bizarchives and, you know, more generally with what's happening in our sphere. Like, basically what the, like, dissident right is or whatever is a kind of, like, echo of this romantic nationalism that we talked about at the beginning. And so, like, it's because, like, what that is, along with the Renaissance before it and many other things that have happened since, it's a rebirth of the Indo-European folk soul. I really genuinely believe that. And it's not just hocus pocus or anything like that. This is something is coming back. We're witnessing the birth pangs of something that is an ethical shift in the way that people think. Folkishness is starting to reassert itself again at long last, and it's a breath of fresh air. I think we can all sort of agree on that. And folk culture is one expression of that. It's one of the deepest expressions of that. And when you get in touch with that, you get in touch with this current that is like, you know, the currents running throughout the ocean that push massive amounts of material this way and that, and the sort of foam on the top is just kind of, you know, it's just kind of like jettying hither and thither. But really what's driving things are these deep folkish currents. And this is what folk tales can do for us. And I really believe that, you know, one of the most purest expressions of this folk culture today is what you're doing, Dave, with the Bizarchives. This is what folk tales look like to us today. They're a living, breathing thing. It's not a museum exhibition behind glass that never changes. It's something that does change, but always remains the same as well. And that's why I'm very much, you know, I appreciate what you're doing, because you're doing the same thing. We're engaged in the same project. So yeah, good on you for that.
Thank you. Yeah, that's, dude, I love what's going on. Like you said, there's kind of like this swell, this font of a different kind of energy coming out now among guys that are traditionally minded. It's not so much about the analytical and necessarily the theoretical, political, or it's more of, there's more art coming out, there's more spirituality coming out, there's more like imagination, and it's like that's the secret sauce that like really creates things that, as you mentioned before, stuff that people love, that fill in the holes where their identities were, you know, arguing about government policies and stuff like that, about whatever. That, I mean, that there's a place for that, obviously, and we should have ideas and discussions about those things. But those don't fill the holes in our souls. They just don't. What fills the holes in our hearts and our souls is like dance and music and art and stories and cooking and like togetherness and like these little things that go into our lives to give them magic, to give them power, and to give them value and meaning. And these are the things that people are willing to die for. You know what I mean? It's like, we rip on the bug men for getting so mad and worked up about their movies, right? When their movies get paused, they flip out, right? They get so mad that Star Wars has a lesbian in it. They get so mad that football is for troons now. Like, they get so mad about that, and we make fun of them. And they, those things aren't really meaningful things. But those are the pieces that they put into their hearts, and that's why that it made them so mad. Because this was part of my identity, you've corrupted it, and now I'm outraged. And that's real stuff. So us tapping back into this creative, the mead of inspiration, right? The furor poeticus is something that is going to manifest things that are truly immortal and bring value back to our lives. Because as Mike said, we're not going to be like, it could happen. But our great king, I don't think, is going to rise up anytime soon and with like a large swipe fix everything. We're stuck in this epoch for quite a while now, and we're just going to have to batten down the hatches and look around our immediate surroundings and fix the pieces that are broken and put color and love. We need to clean our rooms and paint them and decorate them and you know, all that kind of stuff. And speaking of pouring out, I actually, you know, this is how I write. I recently started taking my poetry a little bit more seriously. And Mr. Mike, do you mind if I read a quick poem?
Go for it.
So this just came out of me the other day. Like, I didn't even have words in my mind. It was just like a feeling. It was a concept. And this poem came out, and it's just, I had no plan for it. It just wrote, I just wanted to write something weird, right? And it's called From Space It Came Falling. It goes, here trees grow sideward, a forest unnatural, life force perverted, spirits be wrathful, warping wood wilds, disorder of time, see nature defiled, no reason or rhyme, Foul feral forms, creatures grow twisted. White fangs and black horns know not what bewitched them. Brackish bogs birthing baleful black beasts, slithered slime surfing foul floating foam yeast. From space it came falling, strange hues from it glowing. To all things its calling, strange forces come flowing. Critters now hateful, hungered for flesh, they feast on each other and from their own nests, rapidly spreading, land falling ill, malforming the world to its alien will. Purple skies moan, air reeks of strange sour, it replicated its home, and Earth's been devoured. And that just kind of came out of me, and I was like, that's one of the better poems that I've written.
That was great, man. That was really, really cool.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I enjoyed that very much. Just very, very distinct Howard vibes. But yeah, like with what you were saying about how, you know, it's about doing a whole bunch of different things. It's not just about, like, you know, autistic political, you know, analysis forever. It's about, you know, like, you know, reviving folk dance and like traditional cooking and everything like that. And what this means is that everybody has a part to play. Everybody can do that. This is something that we can all participate in, like the folk culture. So I guess, like, you know, before we go or whatever, I'll just leave you with this thought here, which, you know, it just sort of reminded me what we were talking about, of something that Nietzsche says in his Beyond Good and Evil. I believe that's where it's from, where he talks about the plant, right? Where what the point of culture, like what the Greeks might have called the telos, the goal, the end, the whole point of the thing is the flower, right? It's the flowering at the top, right? So you want these high cultural expressions, these beautiful, wonderful, elaborated, perfect encapsulations of the culture, like a Homer or something like that. But at the same time, that plant will die if you don't tend to the soil. So what you really need to do actually is both. It's not just about cultivating the plant. It's not just about cultivating the flower and tending to it, you know, in this extended metaphor. It's also about making sure that the basis, the bedrock of the society is healthy. And that means tending to the folk, which means tending to folk culture. Because ultimately, where political ideologies come from is they're expressions of that folk soul. So when the ladies from Hearth and Helm are sharing their wonderful content on Telegram and you know, their recipes, and when Patriotic Alternative is doing things like putting together recipe books and stuff like that, that's all exactly the kind of stuff that we need. We only need so many, you know, amateur philosophers, but we sure as heck need a lot more mums and dads and children and people who are just going to enrich, you know, their people's lives. So that's what folk culture can do. And really, if we're not doing that, then we've already lost. So we need to do more of it.
I love it. I love it. We're going to close it out for this evening, but Mr. Mike, dude, I always love having you on, man. You're one of my favorite people. I respect your work very, very much. I have a ton of your books, and I love all of them. I think they're great. You know, Ancient City is great. You have another folktale book that I really, really like. It's a smaller one. What's it called?
Oh, it's Ballads, Weird and Wonderful.
I love that one. That one's so good. He does. He has so many great books. So everybody make sure to go to, is it .org or .com?
ImperiumPress.org.
Go over to ImperiumPress.org and get yourself a copy of Folk Tales in the Indo-European Tradition. That is a threat. Go get yourself a copy. This is a must-have book for everybody that is traditionally minded, heathens, anybody. You got to have a copy of this on your shelf. It should go next to your poetic edit. It should go next to your Bible if you're a Christian. It has to be on your shelf. This is a must-have, tremendous, tremendous book. So go head over there to Imperium Press's website and get yourself a copy and pick up some other stuff that he does. Mr. Mike is he's just a machine, and they got so much great stuff. You know, he's got the Iliad over there. He's got all kinds of stuff. It's really, really great. And also, we talked about O'Gravy earlier. I didn't get a chance to give him a shout. I'm going to shout out O'Gravy from the Sunriders. He just put out a book. I'll drop a link in the description there for him. I haven't had a chance to pick up his book yet, but you know, knowing him, it should be pretty awesome. So shout out to him and the Sunriders over there on Telegram. Make sure to go follow them. And you know, like always, guys, I appreciate you guys. Much love to all the Bog Lords and Bog Maidens out there. If you like the Bog, you support the Bog, make sure you go to patreon.com/thebog and sign up. There's a tier for everybody. $5 all the way up to $50. You get a sticker and a mug. But most importantly, you can get the RSS feed to listen to the audio of every single show that we do in your car, on your commutes, at work, or at the gym. So make sure to go over to patreon.com/thebog and sign up and help us keep the lights on this operation. But if you want to support the Bog another way, make sure to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop and check out some sweet merch. We got beanies, we got hoodies, we got hats, we got shirts, we got all kinds of stuff over there. Dresses for the ladies, onesies for the babies. So go over to shop.spreadshirt.com/bogshop. If you want to support a friend of ours, make sure to go to facebook.com/ironagejodish and check out some authentic ancient Vedic astrology. The stuff's super cool. You guys are going to love it. If you decide to get a reading, tell them Big Dave sent you. Let them know I sent you over there. That's facebook.com/ironagejodish. And then Bizarrechives, guys. Get yourself a copy of Bizarrechives. We got 3 books out. Bizarrechives 1, Bizarrechives 2, and a cosmic horror double feature by A. Cuthbertson. 2 novellas in the cosmic horror Lovecraftian tradition. Weird fiction all around. So if you like fantasy, you like science fiction, you like cyberpunk, you like cosmic horror, you like supernatural horror, you like grimdark, you like post-apocalyptic, all that kind of stuff. Short form, great reads. TheBizarreArchives.com. Go get yourself a copy. We got another book. We got a big one coming out next. So go over, check that out. But like always, I got to raise a horn to our most exalted patrons. Because of their generosity, we are able to stay on the air and deliver content to each and every one of you. So we're going to raise a horn to our good friend Corey and our very own Andre. Hail to them and hail to each and every one of you. Many hails and many blessings and much love to each and every one of you and your wonderful, beautiful families. I'll see you guys next week here on The Bog, 6 p.m. Eastern. I'll see you later.